G'day, it's Daniel Harford. Welcome to the Best of the Breakfast Club on RSN 927. It was jam-packed. Check it out.
It's Adam White is his name. Not the guy from the New England Patriots. The guy from RSN. He's better. Whitey, good morning.
Who are you talking about? The guy from the New England Patriots.
Oh, so not Adam White. A. White. James White.
Sweet Feet James White. That's what he's called.
Is that what he's called, Sweet Feet?
That's what he's called. I'll tell you a very interesting thing. There's quite a few interesting things to talk about today. Joey and I just had a disagreement out the back. I think there's heaps going on at the moment in the world of sport. There's lots of really interesting discussions to have.
Right.
First of all, it is the 1st of December, as you mentioned before, which means that there are lots of elves on shelves that are appearing all around Melbourne today.
What does that mean? What does that mean? I don't know what you're talking about.
The elf on the shelf.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Don't you?
Oh.
There are elves that will be appearing on shelves
all over
Melbourne. Because that's what happens. That's what happens. There's elves.
Says who?
On shelves. Because one appears at our house. And the kids have just been counting down the days until the elf arrives on the shelf.
And what does the elf do on the shelf?
It has to be, magically it appears in different areas of the house every day from the 1st of December until Christmas Eve.
How long has this been? I've never come across this shelf business. How long has this been going on?
I think it's a relatively new phenomenon.
Oh,
I don't think
it's
not the traditional advent calendar type setup.
Well, what's the point? If there's no chocolate a day and there's just an elf on a shelf moving around the house, what's the go?
Well, you probably won't be surprised to suggest in our house that there are also advent calendars with confectionery items available as well.
Well, that makes sense. Now I understand what you're talking about.
Yeah, but no, there are elves on shelves. It starts from today, 1st of December.
So he just moves around the house, this elf, he or she. Mm.
Magically, it appears at a different place in the house. It might be sitting on a shelf, I suggest, or it might be...
not elves on tables.
In the kitchen, bench, or it might be... And you're not allowed to touch it. That's another part of the whole thing. You can't touch it, otherwise the magic goes.
What?
Yep.
What does the elf do?
Just sits there, really.
Hasn't got a job?
Have a job to do because it is a magical thing and it watches the children to make sure that the behaviour is good in the lead up to Christmas. It's keeping an eye on the children.
Right.
So if there is some disrespectful behaviour going on or if there is some antagonistic behaviour going on, if there is some... all those sorts of things. It's just keeping an eye for Santa Claus, just that extra pair of eyes, just to make sure that things are going as well as they can be in the lead up to Christmas.
Right. Okay. Well, at least he's got a job, the elf.
There's a book.
He's just sitting on shelves and just hanging out.
There is a book attached to it. So,
being a goose.
Yeah, you read the book, and then all of a sudden, the elf, and you name the elf, and the elf becomes part of the family for the month of December, and then it magically disappears.
Does it?
Yep. It does.
After what? After the 31st or 24th?
24th.
Well, you said the month of December.
It's almost like Father Christmas or Santa Claus, whatever you say. He picks up the elf and takes him with him on his journey.
All the elves?
Yep.
They go back with him to the North Pole?
Well, because the big sack of toys diminishes as he goes to each household. So I'm assuming that the elves replace the toys.
So hang on. So you're telling me that Father Christmas puts all the elves from all the shelves in the toy sack?
Well,
and just locks them up, breathing.
I'm not sure. It's real cattle class type setup on the way back to the North Pole.
No wonder they're small, these elves. We've got no air.
I'm sure Four Corners would do an investigation under the travelling of the elves back to the North Pole.
Oh, boy. I wasn't aware of the elves' situation.
That's today.
I wasn't aware. Right.
I also had a bit of a setback yesterday before we get on to the sport things, when there's plenty of those. As I said to Joey, lots going on.
What's your name, your elf, just by the way?
Fisbee.
Okay, we better.
I don't know why it was called Fisbee.
What's wrong with Terry? I think Terry should be the name of the elf.
Anyway, I got invited yesterday to do something.
What'd you do? Fantastic.
Mm. I got invited to be to play Santa Claus at the kindergarten. Now, initially, I thought this was a, yeah, obviously, because I'm entertaining with children, I'm engaging with children, I'll do the job very well, obviously, you know, very good parent, and just, I can sort of relate to children. And it was put to me last night that that wasn't the reason why I was asked, that I was asked to be Santa Claus because of the build suited the costume. And the whole setup.
Right. Not because you're a jolly fellow.
Well, and I said, well, surely that someone could do it and just put a like a cushion or a pillow down the front to sort of, you know. Oh, no, but you're much more natural. You really fit the bill quite well.
What was the response?
I haven't spoken to that person since.
Will you help out with the Christmas party?
I wouldn't have thought so. Not on that pretense.
So, oh goodness me!
It was a serious conversation. That was the scariest part. Anyway, we're talking about cricket now. I just had to get that out because I was really quite disappointed with that commentary.
We can't talk about that because we needed. The Bakers told us that John Peter arrived at their place last night, currently in quarantine, under security guard surveillance.
That's a good point.
There is a suggestion that the Baker. Oh, no, I'm not going there. And Juppy says the pest of an elf turned up at my joint last night. Welcome to Anxiety Month.
Well, there you go.
This thing.
There you go. That's right. You've got to find 24. Sorry, the elf has to find 24 places. It is interesting whether those elves had to do 2 weeks of hotel quarantine.
Well, you'd think they would.
Well,
I think Santa's been given exemption, my understanding is.
Is he?
Yeah.
Right. So, the interesting
not
thing
for... Not many cases in the North Pole, I reckon.
No.
Community transmission's been low for a while
That's
now.
That's right. They've been in quarantine themselves because they've been building presents. They've been making presents in the build-up December.
So, the presents all... Nah, I'm not going to get too deep into it.
No, don't. Don't. Because we are a show for all ages.
I'm just wondering who's making the presents if the elves are on the shelves.
No, they're only on the shelves for December. Presents are made. Once the presents are made, that's through the sort of the middle part of the year and into sort of the early sort of September, October. Then it goes into a distribution type setup. So the elves' work is done. They've done the building. So we then go. It goes to another phase.
It's like the pre-season, isn't it?
Okay. So what we're going to say, there's elves. I'm looking at the text messages. There are elves popping up everywhere around Victoria.
No, there was two. There's two.
No,
messages.
There's not.
No,
there's more.
There's two.
There's more.
There might be three. There might have missed one.
They're coming through. They're flooding in.
I'm not sure that's right.
So, with the cricket situation, right?
Right.
We're talking about the fact that David Warner now is unlikely to play the first test. That's the feeling we're getting.
Peter Bruckner will give us more of an insight on that a little bit later on.
Yep. So, the commentary now is all about, well, that means that Joe Burns is safe. So, because it was a sort of a toss-up between Joe Burns and Will Pukowski... It's pretty clear now that it will be a Pukowski-Burns opening partnership.
How come Joe Burns all of a sudden safe?
Exactly. So I'm going to throw this one at you. Now, this will sound incredibly biased, and that's fine. I don't care. Why isn't Marcus Harris being discussed as a potential opening partner for Will Pukowski come the first test? Now, I'll build a case here. They are the two that are putting together these incredible partnerships. And it wasn't just the 486 against South Australia. They backed it up with another big partnership in the next match. Marcus Harris and Will Pukowski are a left-hand, right-hand combination. Marcus Harris has scored a lot of runs now over the last 3 or 4 years at domestic level. Now, albeit he had troubles in the Ashes, as did David Warner to Broad and Archer coming around the wicket. He's made some technical adjustments. I believe that he should be in the frame as a potential candidate for that opening position. Now, Marcus Harris has been named in the Australia A team for the two three-day games. First one starts on Saturday. So we keep talking about this being it's up to Bukowski and Burns to get runs. I would argue that if Marcus Harris was to get runs in one of those two Australia A games, he has to be in contention, because I know that the Australians like to have a bit of variation left-hand, right-hand in their batting setup. And at the moment, if they were to go Bukowski-Burns, there would be right-hander, 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 right-hander for the top four. And I think that they would like the idea of a left-hander near the top as well.
Well, that's not the ratio they're after. They need a left-hander in there somewhere, so that doesn't work.
That's what I'm saying. Bukowski, Burns, Labuschagne, Smith.
Who's five?
They're both left-handers. And Wade are left-handers.
I agree that Joe Burns shouldn't necessarily be safe. If he was on the outer or a chance to be pushed out because of his form anyway, but prior to David being perhaps unavailable, and we'll talk to Cal Ferguson about this too after 8 o'clock as well, I would think that still the question has to hover over him as to whether or not he's the right man to be opening with Will Bukowski in the first test in Adelaide. I think it's a valid question to ask, and I would think if the selectors aren't having these conversations, then they're not doing their job properly, because you can't all of a sudden fall back to Burns and say, oh, well, David Warner's not there anymore, so we've got to keep Burns. Why do you have to keep Burns?
Well, exactly.
If his spot was in jeopardy in the first place, his spot's in jeopardy still.
100%. And what was the number one reason why Joe Burns was going to play?
Because he likes batting with David Warner.
Exactly right.
And David Warner's not there.
Like, Manus Labuschagne said yesterday that Burns is averaging 40 in Test cricket. And he is, pretty much, 38, 39. But we've got to think a little bit more about the relevance of those numbers when you look at what he did last summer against New Zealand and what he then did in the three Sheffield Shield games that he had. He hadn't done a lot. And it's a bit different. You can look at sort of the longer-term picture if you haven't got other players that are, putting up good numbers and building good cases. And in the case here of Marcus Harris, his figures cannot be denied. Now, you can talk all you like about, technically maybe not, or I mentioned the Ashes situation, and he wasn't compelling against India, but he wasn't horrendous in his first opportunity at international level a couple of years ago. I'm just really surprised his name has not been spoken of anywhere in the last sort of 24 to 48 hours.
If you're going on the Ashes, David Warner never plays.
Well, exactly.
It's pretty straightforward if you play that game. So, but he's got runs in the bank. So that's where he wins on that run. Off the SMS, a good point. All the chat was that Burns was going to hold his spot. Why would he get dropped? That's the counter-argument to that. Now, we have been having the discussion about whether Will Bukowski would take Joe Burns' spot, but all the commentary coming from inside the camp up until this point, just to play devil's advocate for a second, was that Joe Burns was going to hold his spot. So if that is the case, then why would they talk about Marcus Harris or somebody else coming in?
The argument on that, as I mentioned before, is because one of the key reasons why Burns was in consideration was because of his partnership with David Warner.
Well, it was an element of the conversation.
Yeah. I'm not anti-Joe Burns. I've been a big fan of Joe Burns for nearly a decade now. But I worry with the way he's been playing recently, that it is a concern, regardless of whether Warner's there or not. He doesn't go into an international summer with good form, and there are others at the top of the order that have got form. So all I'm saying is that when the first game of these two three-day matches, it starts on Saturday. I believe it's on Fox Sports, which is really good, so you can have a look. I just think that you might be surprised that Marcus Harris pops up and gets runs, and all of a sudden they go, oh, gee, why weren't we talking about that? Because he's a man in form, and he has got test match experience there as well. So, and what do they do? Because if there are three there, you can't have three opening the batting. So does Harris and Bukowski open the batting and Burns bat at three, or what would they do?
Well, how come both of them? How come all of them are playing now?
Well, they're all named in the squad. Now, but if I'm the select
player, so that means you've got rid of Head or Wade. and you pushed Steve Smith back down to four and then Marnus down to five.
No, well,
Marnus,
you're not going to do that. But you need those three to play in those matches.
Oh, you mean those matches?
Yes.
Sorry, the three-day games.
Yes.
Sorry.
You need those three to play. Now, you can't have all... Now, the logical way of looking at it to me is you play Burns and Harris opening the batting with Bukowski at three. But, of course, obviously... This is the intrigue about it all to me, is that I see that there are two opening positions now available for that first test if David Warner doesn't get up, and how you give yourself the best chance of looking at the options, it's quite difficult.
Now, Salty in Tassie, who we love, has said you're full of it. Not in so many words, I just sort of made that a bit sexier than it is. He says, Harris not considered because he's got six or seven better ahead of him. Who would be? If we play the game for a second, that Joe is still under pressure and Bukowski comes in and it's not Harris, who are the other contenders for that opening position? Are there other contenders? Are there players in these three-day squads that could take that role?
Well, I think the important thing to add here is that the opening positions are specialist positions. So you are looking at a much smaller pool when it comes to who the players are. So in Tasmania, there's no options there to open the batting. Jordan Silk is the number one man. They've got Wakeham and Doolan that they're using those roles just this year. So Tasmania out of the frame. South Australia out of the frame. Weatherald, who is their best opener, is not even playing at the moment because he's out with mental health reasons, and they've been trying other kids in those roles. In New South Wales, I'm disappointed that Dan Hughes hasn't gone better over the last 12 to 18 months because I think he's good enough to potentially get that opportunity, but he just hasn't made enough runs. Nick Larkin is the other one. I doubt they'll go that way. In Queensland, I mean, look, Usman Khawaja is someone they could go to, but they won't. He bats three for Queensland, or four for Queensland, but has opened the batting for Australia. We obviously know about Burns. Renshaw's another one that is batting five now for Queensland, so I don't think there's really any options there. The only other one that I think they won't go with, but is probably the most informed batsman, opening batsman in the country, outside the obvious, is Sam Whiteman. He's a very good player. He's got, if you look at his form over the last, say, seven or eight Shield matches, it's probably better than anyone's. Now, he's a keeper who has...
another one.
Yeah, he's had some injury concerns over the last two or three years. He's gone to the top of the order. If you look at his runs in the 2020 calendar year in Sheffield Shield cricket, it stacks up with anyone. In fact, it's probably better than anyone's. Left-hander, again, I don't think they'll go that way, but they're the opening options around the country. That's the pool.
53 and 4, 51 and 110, 65 and 18, 114, 4, 118, 14. So he's made three centuries and three half centuries in his 2, 4, 6, 8, 10 innings in the 2020 calendar season in first-class cricket. Yep. Yeah, that's 6 out of 10. 6 out of 10 over 50. That's good. That's good for our man Sammy Whiteman.
So I've just done that off the top of my head, so I hope I haven't missed anybody, but that's the pool you're looking at. For opening batsmen around the country at the moment.
Pekowski's opened three times. He ain't a specialist yet, Othea Smith.
No, I agree with
another
that.
Another good point.
I agree with 100%.
Another good point. Well, what about Marnus? Could Marnus do it? Let's hear from the man himself.
If I got asked to open the batting, absolutely. It's an opportunity that I would, you know, I would enjoy doing.
There you go. Marnus reckons
he
could do it.
One day cricket.
He could do it.
Marnus would do anything. Marnus would come in and bowl pace and open the bowling if he was asked to.
He could open the batting too in Test cricket. Easy.
Well, I mean, if you can bat number three, you can open the batting.
Well, not necessarily.
Well, it means you've got the technique to be able to negotiate the new ball. So while Marnus's technique is clearly unconventional and has changed quite considerably in the last couple of years, it has proven that it can stand up to the moving ball, which he was able to do in England. So I think it's surprised quite a few people with what he's been able to do.
So if it's about partnerships and you get Marcus Harris in because he bats well with Will Bukowski, does that mean that I'm a chance to find the ones this week? Because my partnership bowling with Yogesh Sharma on the weekend was nothing short of outstanding. None for 21 after 8. And during that time, same time, my man Yogesh, who owns that place? He owns
that.
So
you open the bowling.
No, no, just first change. First change. But Yogesh and I bowled together. We bowled 16 overs together.
Yeah.
8 apiece. I got none for 21. He got 6 for 23.
Yeah.
So I claimed most of those wickets because I kept it tight.
I'm suggesting.
So do you think I'll be in the ones this week as well?
Well, look, I don't really know. Yeah, well, there's a chance that if you're playing at my club that you wouldn't be playing. I'm thinking that your none for 21 just jammed the batsman, had them playing straight, suffocating the runs, and then the bloke at the other end was bowling long hops and they were being caught on the fence and he was taking the wickets. Is that sort of how it played out?
Well, Yogesh hit the line of length, he just made them play. And they got carried away because they couldn't score off me, so they had to try and score off someone. Great pressure tactics. I think I have a chance to be in the one this week. Have to be a chance.
You got to train.
I can't do that because Tuesday, Thursday, I'm busy elsewhere. I can't do that. Hey, what did we see yesterday, Whitey, from the Magpies? Jeff Walsh, after 36 years in the business, announced that he would be retiring from football. He's had an outstanding year. What about this? I'm reading through some of his achievements involved in football clubs in 36 years. 25 final series, 25 out of 36, which is a bloody good effort in modern footy. 10 grand finals. One grand final appearance every 3.6 years as the celebrated football administrator of the years. Now, I know that he's in play and all that sort of stuff, but being involved with clubs that have been in 10 grand finals in 36 years, I think anyone in football would love that opportunity. Four flags, AFL Life membership. There was discussion at the post the trade period for the Magpies that there would be a bit of a fallout from an administrative perspective. Do you think he'll be the first Walshy, and then there'll be others following, or is this just Walshy saying, you know what, I've had enough. I've had a good time, 36 years. This didn't go perhaps as we would have liked to have finished here in the Magpies, but it's time for me to hand over.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. It does feel like he's been a bit of a scapegoat in a way. He's obviously, you know, he was 66, isn't he? Is that what he said? 66 years of age?
I don't know how old he is. He's 36 years
between,
in footy.
I think he's between 64 and 66. So he's...
This is like the birthday game.
Yeah, that's right. Three-year threshold. Look, to me, there was never any speculation at any point through the course of the year that that Jeff was looking at retiring. That was never really on the radar. There aren't a lot of good football managers available, and I think Essendon's finding that at the moment as they're looking for the replacement for Dan Richardson. They haven't appointed anyone yet. There have been some names linked to Essendon, but they haven't named anyone.
Old is the latest.
Yeah, thing. Yep. He was in the thick of the action when it comes to the list management and the fallout for what happened at the end of the year. It seems to me that it's I can't see it just being a coincidence. I'm not sure. Now, I'm not saying he's to blame for what happened, but it seems like that they needed to make someone accountable. Does that look like that to you?
I'm hearing a little bit different. I'm hearing that he was most displeased with the whole situation.
Right.
And that perhaps this is the straw that's broken the camel's back. And he said, righto, I've had a gutful.
Right, okay.
That's some of the whispers that I'm hearing coming through my desk.
Well, that's another... you can look at it that way as well. I mean, I can't have it that there can't... That there is no... It's such a botched job with what's happened at Collingwood that there can't be... It's not so much accountability, but there needs to be some sort of change that they've stuffed it up as much as they have. Because history says when these sorts of things happen, there are casualties.
Yes. Yeah, well, normally there are when it gets to a situation like this, and there's been such a glaring hatchet job from administrators in sport. Normally there is a fallout, and there are positions that take the hit. This helps that situation. I think it sort of appeases some of the Magpie Army that have been absolutely just devastated and totally lost faith in the club's ability to manage their affairs. And there's been plenty of those. You talk to any Collingwood supporter around town at the moment, and they are most upset.
Yeah, they are.
Livid with the way it's all unfolded there at the Holden Centre. So this will appease to somewhat, but I think they're still calling for more. All those people that I know.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, this was the saying, you always felt that there was going to be someone that would leave that football club in an administrative role because of what had happened, because that's just what happens. Now, I don't know the inner machinations of who's responsible or how it all unfolded, because largely it's never one person. But history says that change happens whenever something like this takes place. I was surprised that it was Jeff Walsh. I'd be surprised if he isn't looked at by somebody else because of his experience and because of the fact that I mentioned before that there's not that many great football managers around. And David King made the point on Twitter last night that if you look at sort of through the years, that absolute top echelon of football managers, you could probably name them on one hand.
Would never know where to start. Andrew Ireland, Walshy. Who else fits the bill?
Well, Neil Barm.
Oh, yes, of course, the great Neil Barm.
David Noble has been the one that sort of rocketed up in recent times for what he did at Adelaide and then what he did at Brisbane, and now all of a sudden he's the senior coach. But there's
small sample size, not 36 years worth.
But it is half why, over the last decade or so, why Neil Barm's name always is mentioned when a club is looking for a football manager or a head of football, because he had great success, obviously, at Geelong, but he'd been at Collingwood. Now wherever he went, there was success. But largely it's got to do with how good he was, but also that there was never, ever that many outstanding candidates for that particular role at whatever club it was that was looking for one.
Russell Milton, I didn't ask him today because he probably didn't know who Vance Joy was. So there's not much point getting him involved. But get him involved in our soccer chat, absolutely. Russ, good morning.
Good morning, boys. How are you?
Going very well, thank you, mate. Going very well indeed. Hey, there's a bit happening over there at the moment. The conversation around fans getting back into Premier League games at the moment. What's the appetite like from the fans, considering how delicate the community transmission and the world is over there with the virus at the moment?
I think they're all willing to get back into it, really. I'm pretty sure. I mean, I know from our fans at our club that, you know, certainly season ticket holders are desperate to get back and watch us play live from the vibe we're getting. And I think it's the same all across the country, really, from all levels. So there's been fans back in at the lower levels, but not in the professional game or, you know, the two leagues below it. So it's very imminent. I think we're allowing fans back in this Saturday into Cheltenham. Only 1,000, but to start, the club have got to go through, and all clubs will have to do the same, go through a lot of paperwork and safety procedures to allow the authorities to allow them to get the crowds in. So it all depends on what tier they're in as well. Tier 3 will have no fans in, allowed no fans. Tier 2 is, I think it's 20-25%, something like that. So, and Tier 1 can have a few more than that. So we'll see what happens in the next few weeks. I think teams will gradually build it in over the next 2 to 4 weeks. But we're trying to get fans in this Saturday, which will be good. It'll be strange, actually, because it's been a while since we've performed in front of a paying public.
Okay, so there's no real concern. It's just a matter of let's just get back on track and see where it takes us.
I think so, largely. Yeah, I think people want to get back in and see what's and enjoy live football, really, live entertainment. So, and I think it's going to gradually creep in over a few other sports as well.
What's it been like, Russ, just from a general living perspective? I know that the trend is heading in the right direction. The reduction, I think, is around about 30% of cases since the UK have gone into this recent lockdown. How has it affected your life? And I know we've talked about how it hasn't really affected your football too much, but just in general terms.
Yeah, I mean, football-wise, we've been in sort of a little bubble, really. We came back in June for the playoffs. We had another break for a month, and then we came back for the season. So, we're sort of in our little bubble, if you like, at the football ground. I literally go, wake up in the morning, go to work, come back, and don't really do a lot else, really. And it's been like that for a while. We're just coming out of a second lockdown, going into a three-tiered system now, which the government has looked at what's going on around the country and put different areas in different tiers. So tier one to tier three, three is virtually a lockdown again, barring one or two things in all but name. Tier two and tier ones are obviously lesser restrictions on them. But generally, yeah, it'll see the opening up of shops again, restaurants, bars, from Wednesday. So, you know, hopefully that'll start getting things back. And as you said, you know, it's just coming out lately that, you know, the rate's going down. Things are looking better than they were. So hopefully that can continue. And, you know, with fans coming back and things like that, hopefully, you know, we can get sort of start getting back to some sort of normality. I think they're talking about another sort of 6 to 8 weeks of it. But we'll see what happens. And I think, you know, when the weather starts warming up, I think hopefully things will start getting back to a normal life as it was before.
Yeah, and there's also just overnight, I know we're a sports show, but just overnight, that one of the vaccines could be rolled out in the next couple of days with a really high success rate when you're looking at percentages in the 90s. So that has to, what is it, the Moderna one? It's all really very positive. And I think the UK are sort of right in the thick of the action for that particular vaccine. So, we'll see what happens. Just from a Premier League perspective, I want to start with Liverpool. And I know they started back towards the start of the weekend, Russ. But once again, Jurgen Klopp talked about his war with the TV networks. He's had another crack at BT. And we were only talking about this last week. Is it now getting to a point where he's genuinely concerned about his squad and his chances of winning this year?
Yeah, he is. I think he's feeling the pressure a little bit. I mean, they're second, aren't they? You know, on goal difference to Spurs. So they're not, you know, sort of like they've slipped right away. They're right in there, right amongst it. But he's got horrendous. He's probably got the worst injury list in the league. And it shows in his after-match interview on BT Sport with Des Kelly. He started, he got riled quite a bit and had a pop at Des and the authorities, you know, about the scheduling of the games because they were playing Wednesday and then Saturday morning, so there's not a lot of time in between. He thought it was unfair. You know, the authorities have got to do what they've got to do, I suppose, and the teams, like he did say, that, you know, we've got to get along with it, but, you know, at the forefront of it all is my players' safety and welfare, really, you know, football and otherwise. He had James Milner go down as well, so I think he's got most of his back line injured. He's got, you know, a number of forward players injured, so he's looking at bare bones. I mean, he can still put out a quality team. If you look through the side there, he's still got, you know, quality players in most positions, and I think that's the art of a good squad, is that they've got, you know, at least a couple in each position that they can call on to play. So, yeah, he showed that. I think the game as well would have been frustrating for him against Brighton. It was a 1-1 draw. They had two goals disallowed, missed the penalty. And then Brighton scored, but it should be the last kick of the game, which you probably would have said was not a penalty. So it was all conspiring against him. And I think, you know, he probably had to be in his bonnet anyway if they'd have won. But because they drew in the manner in which they drew, I think it was particularly galling. And, you know, it sort of came out in all his frustrations over the last few weeks and months have come out in that one interview, which was a great watch. It was brilliant to see. So if anyone could go and have a look at it and, you know, watch it, go and have a look at it. It was good to see. But he had a good point. You know, you can see both sides, can't you? The leagues are shorter this year as the time span. So everything's got to be crammed in and somewhere's got to give. We've just had 5 subs allowed onto the pitch being put in, certainly at our level. I'm not sure if it's the same at Premier League level, I can't remember, but certainly at the lower levels it is. You can have 5 substitutes, you know, you can make 5 substitutes. So, it's going to be an interesting time. It's a case of who can stay fit, really, who's going to do well in the league.
Max Gawn is a significant contributor, just a big man doing big things is what he is, the captain of the Dees. He joins us again on The Breakfast Club. Nice to touch base, Maxie. Good morning.
Morning, Half, Whitey, Jim. It's been a little rest. I haven't seen you talk to you guys for a good month or two.
No, I know. We gave you a bit of a spell. We know it's been a long year, and we'll just let you freshen up for a big campaign at the back end of the year and, of course, for 2021. But you haven't exactly freshened up yourself. Did you ride 172Ks on the weekend?
Yes, I did. I don't know. It got really big on me really quickly. it was 36 degrees up in Bright.
And
there was a couple of big climbs that we did, and the wind was around in the afternoon. So it was a big day. The 171 felt a bit more over 200, but it was for a good cause. It was for the hunger. It was called the Hunger Ride, which was for Food Bank Victoria, which puts meals on tables for young Australians that are in poverty. And there was 32 riders, and we raised, between the 32 riders, we raised 130-odd grand. So hopefully that puts a few meals on a few tables.
Max, Jimmy Bartel here. Firstly, well done on amazing cause and raising all that money. But secondly, well done on getting through the rider. I couldn't imagine you would have done much cycling with all the hub life through the season, or were you able to get a bike up there in Queensland and all the different hubs just to get some K's in the legs, as they say?
It's funny, Jim. Early on, they said you can sort of bring one activity thing with you on the plane, and then we can work out how to bring some other stuff up. But most people were bringing golf clubs and surfboards. My bike was the first thing that came up, so I had the bike. It worked out quite well because our hub was our resort was quite spread out, so I used the bike to get to dinner and breakfast and stuff like that. But then I was able to go for a couple of rides, which was good, up in the sunny coast. And yeah, so I was able to keep my legs ready for a 171k bike ride. But yeah, as Whitey knows, I've been doing a few rides since I've been back as well.
Whenever we used to do any riding down at Geelong, it was really clever to tuck in behind the ruckman or the key position blokes and just get the free ride for whatever ride. When you did the ride recently, 32 people, how many people just kept trying to slip in behind your big frame to get up the hills?
Yeah, the first 30k, I accidentally found myself on the front and no one was swapping. And that was a bit of a headwind to start. So I get my role and I play my role, but I'm not going to sit there the whole day.
So 171 kilometres, how long in 36 degree heat up mountains, how long did that take you?
It was about, there was obviously a couple of stops. It was about 6.5 hours.
Right.
I think we averaged about 28 k's an hour for the day.
Gee, that's impressive considering the hills you're climbing.
Yeah, well, the descents are where I come into action.
Yeah, that's right. So is it something that, I mean, I know you're very passionate about it. Is it something now that you're going to sort of use as an additional pre-season tool, or is it just something that you can only really do as a sort of a hobby, a leisure activity?
Both, I'd say. It's definitely something you can use with the running. It's not going to replace running. Running is a completely different type of fitness, but you can use it with your running and be able to get, obviously, a competitive advantage and get yourself fitter than the rest. And then also, like, it's just a hobby. I'll do something probably at the end of every off-season. I'll do some sort of ride. Unfortunately, couldn't travel anywhere, so Victoria was the place I had to go. But to be honest, I've never done a Victorian climb, and Mount Buffalo is one of the more beautiful places I've been to, so I'll probably do it again.
Yeah, it's interesting. So we talked to Jack Revolt last week, and obviously he is a premiership player again, and it's been a month since Richmond won the premiership, and he's just starting to get back into trying to do some running and get some fitness into him. So you've had that additional month off. How do you feel physically, but also how do you feel mentally, and when did it get to the point where you could kind of put the fatigue of last year behind you and all the uncertainty and start to look forward?
Normally, Whitey, we go away at this time of the year. We sort of try and go somewhere, whether it's in Australia or New Zealand, or we go completely across the world and go to America. But that's obviously off the cards this year. So it's actually felt like the longest sort of off-season I've ever had.
Right.
Just sitting at home. The running program got introduced pretty early. We had the first sort of 2 or 3 weeks off, but I couldn't stay still as well. So I was going for a few jobs and, but we've still got, I'm pretty sure the older guys still have 5 weeks today. So it's still a long way to go before we're back. You could have not run once and still get fit probably in five weeks. So that's, we've still got a bit of time. But I'm feeling fresh. I've definitely enjoyed being back home, being back around friends and family, and running down on the ovals that I live down here and going for rides. And I've definitely freshened up compared to most off seasons where I usually travel and cram in as much as I can, as much as possible. This is more of a carefree sort of relaxed vibe.
Because it is interesting, even just you saying it then, it doesn't feel like that long ago you were talking about the running sessions you were doing at the local park. Correct me if I'm wrong, with Jaden Hunt there at one point. And, you know, that wasn't pre-season. That was during the lockdown period. So I'm just interested in getting back into it now. How you feel about it? Is it okay? Or are you going, oh, God, we're doing this already now? I'm just interested in your headspace.
It's a great memory that I was running with Jaden Hunt there. That was in April. I did. When I first got sent the running program, the first day is a novelty, but maybe day two of the running program, I did have that thought, Whitey, where I was thinking the grind's back. And it was a pretty tough session, so I wasn't really enjoying it. But now I do love running, so that helps. And there's just this strong desire every pre-season that I go through, because we've basically failed in every season that I've been involved in. You go into pre-seasons with a strong desire to get fitter and better and stronger, and you really, really, really want success, and you want to finish a season where you're not angry and you're actually to enjoy your off-season. So that's what's driving me again, and that's what's driving most of these young guys to do their running and get better, I suppose.
Dr. Peter Bruckner, he gets stuff done, well, every day. He's been doing it for years. He's the best in the business, and he's a former Australian cricket team doctor. In fact, he's a former Australian every team doctor, let's be honest. he's been doing it that long, and he's been good enough to join us this morning on The Breakfast Club. Good morning, Brookie.
Morning, Harp. Good to talk to you guys.
Lovely to have you with us. Is there a team you haven't worked with, just by the way, that you would like to have worked with, Brookie?
No, I pretty much ticked the boxes so far, I think. So no, I've been very, very fortunate. But clearly, teams get sick of me after a while and move me on, so I have to find someone else to work for. So, you know, that's the way it goes. A bit like radio, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I know the feeling. Don't worry about that. I know the feeling. Hey, Brookie, what's the latest, from your knowledge, your understanding of the situation with David Warner? How delicate is this race against time for him now with this groin injury?
Yeah, it's cutting it pretty fine. He's got, a pretty, what we call in footy circles, a standard groin strain of his adductor muscle. And if he were a footballer, we'd be saying he's probably four to six weeks. He's obviously only had 17 days from the time of the injury to the first test. Is it less demanding than playing footy? Well, I'm not sure it is, really. You know, the way he runs and feels and so on, I think it's pretty much the same sort of demands on you physically. So I think he's cutting it pretty fine. I'd say he'd be extremely doubtful for the first test. I reckon he'll make the second test. But at this stage, you'd have to say he's pretty doubtful for the first test.
Doctor, Jimmy Bartel here. You mentioned he's doubtful, but with all technology and all that we know with muscles and injuries, is there anything you can do to make it quicker? We hear players who they do an injury and they say 6 weeks and they go, I'll be back in four. Is there any way that Dave Warner could go, well, I'll be back in 18, 19 days?
Yeah, look, I mean, it's possible. Muscle, I mean, you can't really accelerate the healing of muscles that much. Obviously, he'll have lots of treatment and lots of strengthening and so on. But basically, muscle tissue takes a certain amount of time to heal. And we can't fiddle with that too much. It's like a hamstring. We know it's probably a 3-week injury. And, you try and get back at two and you just, it usually doesn't work. Sometimes it does, but it usually doesn't work. You've got to go on the odds, really. So that, most people, if they came back after this injury after 17 days, would probably struggle. But Davey is he's a good healer. He's supremely fit. He's got, great sort of, physical capacity. If anyone could do it, he might be able to, but I still think it's cutting it pretty fine. And it's very risky. He does it again, and then he's out for the whole season. Whereas if he misses one test, he's probably going to be okay for the rest of the summer. So I think that, it'd be a huge risk to take.
I'm rapt, Pete, that we can chat to you today because you've got that great experience of working in multiple sports. And the reason why I wanted to talk to you is just about the difference between, say, a cricketer and a soccer player, or a cricketer and a footballer, about the muscle that he's actually torn. Because do athletes in different sports prepare differently, or do they use different muscles? So if it was a footballer, they might sort of get over it quicker, or will a cricketer get over it quicker because they're not using those muscles as much, if that makes sense?
Yeah, look, I think it's a good question, Adam, and I'm not sure anyone really knows the answer to it. I mean, I think you could certainly say that, you know, 20 years ago, cricketers and footballers were very different animals. You know, there was not the emphasis on physical preparation in cricket than there is now. And, you know, footballers, I remember, used to be very dismissive of cricketers. They were saying they're not real athletes. You know, when you get, you know, well, I was going to mention Bernie, but I won't. But, you know, people are a bit overweight and so on. But, you know, I think nowadays it's very different. And, you know, having been with the cricket team, I know how hard they train, how demanding it is. So I think you can sort of exclude that now, that they're now genuine athletes who work very hard. And, you know, probably the demands on their groin are not as consistent as in football. There's not that sort of constant change of direction as in soccer or AFL. But there certainly is change of direction, I mean, both in the field and when they're running. You know, particularly taking a quick twos and quick threes, you know, that change of direction at the end of the first run is pretty rapid. You know, it's as rapid as any sort of footballer is going to be. So there are demands on the groin, probably not as much from an overall load on the groin as there is in football, but still significant demand. So, you know, I think there are certain similarities, and I think we can, you know, we can assume that the timelines to get back are somewhat similar to football.
Yeah, it's interesting because a lot of people wouldn't realise, because a lot of cricket's watched on television, but to actually see those cricketers, particularly the batsmen, the way they're built now, they're almost like Formula One drivers. They're tiny because they try and have as little weight on them as possible because they're on their feet all the time. So it's interesting how the cricketer has changed in the way that they physically prepare for their sport compared to, as you were talking about, more the David Boone era.
Yeah, they tend to be shorter. I mean, I think the top batsmen have always, you know, you go right back to Bradman and Neil Harvey and these guys, they've always been pretty short. There's exceptions, aren't there? And you know, there's always sort of the taller batsman is always described as being very elegant because of they put their front foot down and it looks very impressive and so on they drive. But by and large, they tend to have been shorter in stature. But, you know, they're certainly a very different athletes than they were, you know, 20 years ago. It's quite dramatic. And there's, you know, some of the old crew in cricket thinks it's gone too far, that there's too much emphasis on the physical. But if you're playing T20 cricket in particular, and that sort of is, you know, that's really, one day cricket and T20 has really changed the way cricketers prepare. And that carries over now to the test team. And you see, you know, the running and the fielding is just completely different to what it was, certainly when I grew up watching, you know, cricket back in the days, when it was a very leisurely pace, even at, you know, test level. Whereas now, even test level is quite quite intense and high intensity. It's quite a dramatic change, probably more so than just about any other sport I can think of.
Time for our local legend segment on The Breakfast Club. Jimmy Bartel with us until 8 o'clock. Kel Ferguson not too far after that. And I reckon Kel Ferguson might want to maybe even find a way to get this next gentleman into some sort of cricketing system that he's a part of. Because on the weekend, Daniel Bellard went out there for the Delacombe Park Cricket Club, just tucked in there in Frankston. And he made a record score for his club, and I want to find out how it happened because I think it was most unusual. Daniel, good morning to you.
Morning, Harth. How you going, boys?
Going very well, mate. Not as well as you, though. Not as well as you. Tell us what happened to you on the weekend against Mornington.
Well, it was a bit of a slow start. I was on a roping batsman, just, you know, quick singles, a couple of pull shots, and then about 40 off about 20 overs, and then I sort of twinged my quad. And I said to the captain, I can't run anymore. I'm just going to have a swing. And I thought I'd get maybe an extra 20 or 30 runs. And the swing kept swinging and, yeah, just kept going over the fence. And, yeah, just caught fire and kept going with it. And, yeah, all happened.
So you were one of those injured cricketers that are the bane of all opposition teams around the nation, where you're not quite sure what to do. Whether you get a bowl and take it easy on him because you're injured, or you try and bowl harder at him because they're injured, or what sort of havoc you're going to cause. When did you know that you were starting to catch fire?
There was a spinner who I just couldn't get him away in the first spell. And because I like the ball coming onto the bat, and I was doing that thing. He's one of those old guys who just takes forever to get to the other end. I was dancing down the pitch and missing it, and it's in my pat. And then the captain took him off in the second spell. It was just like, I think I hit him for 3 sixes and a four in that over. And when he came back on, I was like, oh yeah, nah, this is happening. So yeah, that was a good day out though. So I almost pulled out actually. I had a groin twinge. I heard you talk about Dave's groin and a bit of an ankle injury. So I had the pads on in the backyard. I was running free, seeing if I could get up for the game. And I'm pretty happy. I had three injuries, and then I thought, I'll just start swinging, and yeah, away we go. But also the captain, Bill Mallinson, made 88. Understated. He helped convince me to play this year as well. So yeah, so give a shout out to him. So yeah,
no one cares about the 88, mate. You made 218.
Yeah, there's nothing understated about an 88. Now, actually, that just caught my attention. Who oversaw the fitness test in the backyard? Was it the missus on the back porch give the thumbs up or thumbs down? Did the whole team come around and watch?
No, just me and the dog. The dog was curious why I had done. Yeah, that was about it. Thanks for the tip on the elf on the shelf too, Jimmy. I didn't know you'd give him a name. So the kids went out and they called the elf Jangle this morning. So Jangle the elf, our elf is called now.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, because then you can say Jangles has been watching. I've got to go have a chat to Jangles and see how you're doing. Yeah, so it keeps them on edge. Now, normally you can go into the rooms and you can sort of not walk, you float through the rooms to the bar and everyone is buying you a beer and celebrating your 200. How did you celebrate it? Or is it just, you just had to gloat via text messages to all your mates that night, just going, look, I don't even need two legs to make 200. I did it on one leg.
Well, obviously I text a picture of the scoreboard to Facebook because my missus was actually in the country visiting her parents. So I text her, and I was using her car, so I said, Lisa Ballard, your car's going to have a sleepover tonight. And text the scorebook. And then, President Juddy said, I don't have to buy any drinks. So in the end, I was just sort of walking behind the bar and grabbing myself a Bundy. So I had a few at the club. And then there's not really much you can do with the COVID at the moment, late. Mm. So we went out to a little bar in Frankston called the Hot Bar. So we had a couple of pints there and then wrapped it up. But yeah, still, I was a little bit dusty the next day. Wasn't too bad, but yeah, just coincided with the wife being away, which was just like perfect synergy. So
that's heaven. That is heaven. Our local legend, Daniel Bellard, Delacombe Park Cricket Club superstar after his club record 218 on one leg on the weekend, joined us. Is there any truth to the rumour, Dan, that you had to leave said wife's, who was in the country's car, at the club?
Yeah, no. I went and got it the next day, of course. So yeah, that stayed there. So
was she comfortable with that?
Look, I don't think she had much of a choice, really. So if cricket clubs have car sleepovers, Captain Bill's car was nestled nicely next to mine when I picked it up in the morning. So yeah, the cricket clubs always have car sleeping overs. Always one or two, you know, who's had a few extra that night when you drive past in the morning.
Callum Ferguson is a legend of Australian cricket. We love him on the Breakfast Club. Always great with his time and great insight and analysis. His My Cricket page is through the roof, if you don't mind. He joined us on the Breakfast Club. Good morning, Cal.
Halfy, Whitey. Thanks for having me again. You're under the pump there, Whitey.
Yeah, well, see, you don't go through these things because your stats are all accurate. But when the My Cricket stats are not accurate and they go against what they should be, no, I get very angry about it.
They're accurate.
No, they're not.
They are, my word. No, I'm concerned that you've only made 30 runs this year, by the way.
A little bit short, Whitey. I'll give you that. They do stop a little bit short.
There you go. See, you've had that issue as well, have you?
Oh, no. He's on cricket info. Like, he's at the serious level.
We're going to go to My Cricket, and Callum goes to cricket info.
I'm just concerned about his finals record, Callum. We'll talk about it another day.
I want to talk about
it. No, you don't want that question, do you?
No, it's not good. It's my skeleton in the closet.
That's funny. That is excellent. Your response is even better. Hey, Cal, how have you seen the one-day series so far? Obviously, it's been a run fest, and I'll get to what Ian Chappell said shortly, but
the run fest between both teams at 1,400 runs in the last two games. It's quite extraordinary.
Yeah, it has been. And look, if you look at the two sides, the big difference has been the ability to take wickets early in the innings or even in the first half of the innings. The Indians are running at about four wickets in the first 80 overs of the innings so far. It's not been a good time of it for their bowlers. I know Virat Kohli's come under some heat back home in India, perhaps for not using his strike bowlers enough in the early stages of the games. It's been very lopsided. The Australians have been absolutely brilliant. I mean, just getting to watch the openers from the Australian team go about their business and set up these big totals has been really impressive. Aaron Finch and David Warner have been so good for so long. I think it's inevitable that they'll end up being our best ever opening partnership in one day cricket, and they're not far off it already, but they've got years ahead of them, the two of them. So it's inevitable, and I think it's just been an absolute pleasure to watch them go about it in this series so far and just let the fireworks come in behind them. It's been incredible, hasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely has been. And we've been talking, Callum, over the last couple of days about the Indian bowling attack. Now, it's been sort of much feared in the last two or three years. How much do we read into these last two matches because of the conditions, the preparation, etc., and how much of it should India be a little bit worried about the ease of which they've played, particularly Bumrah?
Yeah, look, it's the wicket at the SCG has been fantastic for batting. What I have noticed is it's probably been as consistent with regards to bounce as I've seen for a long, long time. Usually there's a little bit of unevenness, and when I say that, it's not a huge amount, but you know, when the bowlers really bend their back, they might get a tiny bit of variable bounce, especially with the new ball, which can cause a few problems for the batters. This wicket, or both wickets, have been fast, bouncy, especially with the new ball, and there hasn't been any sideways movement at all. And I think what you'll see is that once the new balls come off, the shines come off the ball, that extra pace that Bumrah in particular can create in that bounce just hasn't been there for him. And I think that's where some of the fans over in India have been a bit disgruntled. Is, you know, he only bowled two overs with the new ball the other night. And it's been quite an amazing reaction back over there. They're calling for change of leadership. That's how far it's gotten. And, that's certainly, we're not that quick to judge on, you know, one or two captaincy decisions. But certainly over there, they can really get quite narky quite quickly. So, look, it's been an absolute domination from the Australian batting. And what we understand is that most sides are significantly better in their own home conditions. Australia's very good over here. India usually quite good over here, but haven't been able to get into the game because the Australian batsmen, once we've won the toss and batted, just have not let them in. And that's a sign of a very mature and very, very, very strong Australian team. And I think we're going to be hard to beat against anyone in the world going forward, especially in our conditions, because this side is really getting close to its pomp, I think.
Callum, take us through the difference for a batsman playing a red ball versus a white ball. And, you know, you've the perfect person to talk to because of your experience. It seems that the runs, the ball seems to be harder. It seems to come off the bat quicker. It's not seeming to move as much as perhaps it used to. Tell us the difference, particularly when you're facing the absolute best in the world.
Yeah, it is a major difference. What we do see in the red ball contest is the ball pretty consistently in the first probably 20 overs move around a bit. And it may not be extravagant, but at least there's, you know, you've got the slips in place because the odd one is doing something off the wicket or in the air. In these two games, there's been zero movement through the air and there's been even less off the wicket because the wicket's just been so good. It makes a huge difference because when you're not having to worry about a ball nipping back in at your stumps or leaving you off the wicket, it allows you to start freeing up with regards to potentially just getting your front leg out the way a little bit more and almost not premeditating entirely, but just getting yourself into positions to access certain areas of the ground. And what we've seen in the last two games, there's been a lot more movement around the crease from the batsman earlier in the innings than what you might normally see when there's somewhat movement in the air or off the wicket. And because the batsmen are so confident in the ball coming on straight, coming on truly off this fantastic surface at the SCG, they're not afraid to move outside leg stump a little bit, move across their stumps, because they know they're just not going to miss the ball. Whereas when there's a bit of movement in red ball cricket consistently, you know, there's more grass on the wickets. You can't afford to do that, because if you move back towards leg stump a little bit further and look to line up a length ball and hit it through the offside, and it does even a small amount, your stumps are under threat, the inside edge of your bat, you know, maybe a little inside edge onto the stumps or a nick because your eyes are away from the line of the ball. It's just such a significant difference, and the confidence levels in being able to move around the crease then start to diminish because you're not 100% sure if it'll nip back at you or nip away from you towards the slip. So it makes a stark difference. And I think we sometimes talk about how batsmen have really improved in certain areas of their game compared to red ball cricket. You know, we'll see them play in test cricket and find a few issues around their defence. When they come back into the one day side and start playing really solid and looking like everything's hitting the middle of the bat, and we say, oh yeah, their defence has improved. Well, it's not until potentially we've seen it against the red ball that you really start going, okay, well, that improvement's there. Or we find, okay, maybe they haven't quite made that big step yet. And that's where sometimes the Indian players with the bounce can get found out. Sometimes we've seen our players get found out by the lateral movement over in England. But it is a big difference between playing against the red ball and the white ball, because the wickets are so significantly different. It's not necessarily that it's just the new white ball compared to the new red ball. It's quite often just the wickets that make the difference.
Hey, we just want to touch base with Liam Santamaria, who's a very well-renowned NBL analyst and basketball guru around town, in regards to the situation with Andrew Bogut. We believe there may be some news being announced in the next little while. Liam, good morning.
Hey guys, good to be with you.
Great to have you with us. Now, we know that Scotty Hobson's signing at Melbourne United's big business in the NBL, but hopefully we're going to chat to Scotty tomorrow. What's happening with Andrew Bogut? What's the news? Because we believe there's an announcement coming shortly.
Well, we're waiting to hear from the big fella. It's been a long off-season with uncertainty surrounding Andrew Bogut and his next basketball moves. But he let us know earlier in the year that, you know, he was not ready to sign back on with the Sydney Kings and wasn't, you know, comfortable putting pen to paper really in any way, shape or form at that time. He wanted to see how things played out. And he has let it known that he's going to be making some kind of statement on his new podcast. That's the way in 2020, isn't it? Start up a podcast. And he's using the opportunity to grow the brand a little bit. So 10 o'clock today, we're going to hear from Bo. And there's some suggestion he's going to state what his immediate plans are.
It's a real sort of LeBron James type areas from a few years ago. So we know that it's not the two Victorian clubs or the two Melbourne-based clubs. We know it's not the Sydney Kings. Have you got any inkling at all? Because Brian Gorgian has said if Andrew's to play in the Olympics next year, he wants him playing basketball.
Yeah, well, I mean, you would imagine that would be Bogut's plan, wouldn't you? That he one last kind of Boomers campaign to close it out. And you know, obviously the Olympics have been pushed back to 2021, still uncertainty surrounding that tournament in its own right. So how he plans to kind of prepare for that is the big question. Now, as you say, there's a few NBL teams that are, you know, certainly off the table. They've come out and said, it's not us. He's not coming into our squad. But you look around the league, and really most of the teams are pretty much full at this point. The Kings themselves, who he's played with the last couple of years and is set to take an ownership stake with when he does eventually hang up the boots, they do have a spot free still at the centre position. They've got an import spot up their sleeve. My mail is that they're going to be filling that with an import. So I don't suspect it's going to be with the Sydney Kings. Now, the question is it going to be in the NBL
at all.
Yeah.
Or is he going to be doing something different? Is he talking with an NBA club and has a different plan in place? Or has he got something lined up completely out of left field? Has he decided it's time to hang up his kick? So we all wait with bated breath to what the big fella announces later this morning.
That was the best of the Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.